This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 5th of January, 2017, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's program,
our nation has no policy and thus no strategy for cyber deterrence. This appearance of weakness has been provocative to our adversaries who have attacked us again and again with growing severity.
U.S. senators today demanded answers over Russia's alleged hacking that American intelligence services believe may have affected the recent presidential election. America's top spy weighed in with his view. We'll find out what he said and whether the president-elect will ever agree. Plus, staying in America, will Republicans destroy Obamacare? And if so, what will replace it? We'll also be talking about the delicate skills needed to negotiate Brexit. And later on, we'll recount our own top horror stories from airports around the world. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Tom Rivers, ABC News Radio London correspondent, and Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London. Tom and Rosemary, welcome to you both. We will begin with today's events on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. America's Senate Armed Services Committee held a hearing today on cybersecurity, yet, understandably, the majority of the proceedings focused on Russia's alleged hack of the Democratic National Committee, which led to a series of embarrassing leaks ahead of the presidential election. President-elect Donald Trump, of course, refuses to acknowledge that the intelligence community's assessment on Russia influencing the election is correct. Today, James Clapper, America's top spy, noted that his foreign counterparts are concerned over Trump's lack of confidence in his own government employees. Tom Rivers, let's begin with you. This is a strange situation, is it not, where you have a president-elect openly in disagreement, mm-hmm. and quite obvious disagreement, with his own intelligence services?
Certainly so, but look at the recent history of America, and he uses a real, real good ploy when he sends that message out through a tweet form to America and says, these are the same people that said Saddam had WMDs. That really resonates with America. People are not taking the bait like they did 20 years ago. Well, people are a bit more savvy, I think, Rosemary.
Well, yes, but I think it's interesting because at the time that the intelligence services were claiming that it was almost certain that Saddam had a program and that it was expanding and so on, and they deceived Colin Powell into giving embarrassingly false testimony in front of the United Nations. My perception at the time was that we all knew that the intelligence agencies do what an administration requires of them, and that there was a competition between Cheney and Rumsfeld, Pentagon and White House, versus Colin Powell at State, and that this was the nature of the problem. I never thought that the intelligence agencies would do their own thing, irrespective of the administration.
Well, indeed, and I don't want to go back and relitigate what happened in 2003 and the run-up to that. But, Thomas, one thing for ordinary Americans to say, look, I have some concerns about mm-hmm. trust in the CIA and to an extent the FBI as well, over past errors, past issues. But it's another, surely, for Donald Trump, who's about to be president, to publicly say, essentially, that he's siding with Vladimir Putin over the intelligence agencies, and to, as he said yesterday, seem to suggest that Julian Assange of WikiLeaks knows more than the CIA and should be trusted more than the CIA.
Well, it's interesting, yeah. And we'll see, he'll get his own personal briefing tomorrow, right after the president gets a briefing as well from, I believe, the FBI director, CIA director, NSA as well. And we'll see what comes on the backside of that briefing for Trump, if he's changed his tune or not. At this stage of the game, we don't know. But, of course, the committee meeting today is not going to shed a whole lot more light. We're not going to find the specific sourcing. We're not going to know the technicalities, any of that sort of thing. We're supposedly getting, the public's getting a declassified version sometime next week as well. But again, when you're dealing, again, with the realm of unnamed officials citing unattributable sources, it's hanging out there for criticism. And I think that's part of the bandwagon that's behind Trump saying, let's get some meat. Where's the beef? Let's find out exactly what this is and then put it through the test of journalism to see if it is, in fact, emanating from Moscow or not.
In the meantime, I would suggest that the intelligence agencies are not stupid, and they will readjust the advice and the findings that they present to the new president in order to protect their place in Washington. It's an endless competition between the different agencies for slices of the U.S. federal budget.
Hang on, sorry. So you think that they will change? Yeah. So right now they've said this is the evidence that we believe we have that links this hack to Russia. And let's also be clear on this. This isn't just the CIA who's saying this. This is all sorts of other intelligence experts who's looked at it.
The Russians are hacking the US communication system all of the time. Mm. It is understood that the US is hacking the Russian communication system all of the time. So the only point of contention is who leaked what to Assange.
But, sorry, just to go back to what you were saying, are you suggesting that you think the CIA will change their report based on trying to appeal to their new president?
That is the explanation of what they were finding at the time of the Iraq invasion and the year leading up to it. Therefore, I'm sticking to the same logic, basically, here, and saying that the senior members of any U.S. agency, intelligence agency, will sift through what the junior analysts come up with for the things that they know will be of interest to the prevailing order on Capitol Hill and in the White House.
I'm a little surprised to hear you both being so sceptical about what the CIA are saying. Not just what the CIA is saying, but also what President Obama is saying, that you really think that nothing has been proved here, suspicion.
I think, Steve, at this point, and I'm not being cynical for the sake of being cynical, but I think, and again, we're into the realm, too, of we're not internet technical computer experts. But at least if they could say, you know, these are the markers. These are the things which tell us that it began in this IP address in this particular town, et cetera, that might be useful. As opposed to saying, you know, they say the weather's going to be nice tomorrow. They say that my team's going to win tomorrow. And you know what else they say? Well, that's where we are right now. It's hanging by nothing. Sheer nothing. And people, once people have been burned second time around, as we talked about at the beginning, people are a little bit shy and they're looking for the truth.
Let's move on to another big issue that's being talked about a lot in Washington today and will have a big impact, obviously, once Donald Trump becomes president. And that's what happens to Americans' healthcare, Rosemary. Obamacare, named by the Republicans. Obama obviously never named it after himself, but he seems actually relatively happy to stick with it now that there are 20 million Americans who have healthcare who didn't before, seems to be on the chopping board. Republicans are saying they're going to repeal it. President Obama has been on Capitol Hill trying to work with Democrats about how they can fight back to try and keep as much as possible of his signature healthcare policy. Do you think, Rosemary, that when push comes to shove, Republicans are going to find it difficult to, when it comes down to it, take healthcare away from 20 million people?
My understanding is that it would not happen overnight, and that what the Republicans have in mind, with Trump's enthusiastic backing, is to chip away at this system and only incrementally introduce a substitute. And I think since it was so big on the Trump list of promises, they've got to start somewhere. And it was Trump who said, please don't start with doing away with the ethical checks and the ethical procedures that try and check up on the ethical behavior of Congress. Start with something that we can get our teeth into. And Tom knows much more about
very much. So. Yeah, I think he's going to use executive orders. He's also going to use legislation. And as Rosemary says, it's going to take time. And as we saw after he won the election, he even said things like, you know, there's some aspects he will cherry pick and say things like people with preconditions still being able to get private health insurance in America. He says, I support that because a lot of these insurance companies will stiff arm you and say, no, we're not going to take you on board because you're going to cost us a heck of a lot of money. It's going to be a process that evolves, and it won't be done overnight.
And that would make it really hard for Obama and co. to oppose. I find it quite interesting that the Obama family have decided to pitch their tent in Washington, mm-hmm. and he's given every indication of wanting to lead on a couple of big issues to defend his legacy, Obamacare being one of them, and the agreement with Iran being another of them. But I think with this Obamacare thing, because it's so complex, and if the Republicans do succeed in dismantling it piece by piece, it'll be much harder to attack their approach.
Tom, do you think that what we are perhaps more likely to see is a reform of Obamacare? It won't necessarily be called a reform, but there will be things that will be changed about it enough that will enable President Donald Trump, as will be, to say, I've got rid of this and replaced it with something mm-hmm. better, Trump care or...
You know. A much slimmed down version, yeah. and it'll be there, you would hope, as a maybe the final part of the catch net to if you can't get this program or if you can't fall into this one or if your work doesn't have this, et cetera, you can at least get this kind of insurance coverage if you're out there, maybe you're self-employed or et cetera, but it will be stripped down certainly over the next few years.
And there's an interesting challenge, Rosemary, isn't there, for Democrats on the Hill of how they deal with President Trump. There is a lot of talk now of, well, look, you know, they should work with him where they can find agreement. We should be able to find some bipartisan solutions and so on. But Democrats surely are within their own, within their right to turn around and say, well, you guys didn't do that for Barack Obama. You opposed everything he did. Every step of the way, why should we be so kind and generous?
I don't want to be anecdotal about this, but I have just come back from spending just over a week with close friends in Washington, where I once lived for a spell. And they are telling me that the Democratic Party is in much worse trouble than the Republican Party. You would think, as a result of the way that Trump made his way to the nomination of the Republican Party and his difference with mainstream Republicans over a number of issues would create problems for that party. But what I'm being told is the way Hillary Clinton stole the nomination from Bernie Sanders. And, of course, there were the leaks that we were talking about earlier that revealed in what sense they stole the Republican.
Sorry, hang on. What do you mean they stole? She won 3 million more votes than Bernie Sanders.
No, the nomination.
Yeah. She won 3 million more votes than Bernie Sanders.
Okay. No, I think Tom can help me here. But it was a manipulation of the party machine in her favor because the party machine did not want Bernie to win. They wanted Clinton.
Exactly. Well, and they got rid of the five top DNC officials in the process. You don't walk away unless there something was going on there. So you're absolutely right.
No. So sorry. But. There was no stealing. She won 3 million more votes than Bernie Sanders.
But you organized those votes. By the same token, Donald Trump, she stole the election from Donald Trump, but that is not the case.
Sorry, I don't understand.
There were more Americans who voted for her on a head count in the presidency race than there were in terms of the delegates.
Yes. So to get back to the Democratic Party, Tom Rivers, and what it does next, as Rosemary's saying, it is in as you would expect after you lose an election, there's a bit of a crisis. Everyone tries to work out what we did wrong, where we go next. And in the case of the Democrats, is it, you know, should we have been more to the left? Should we have had more of a Bernie Sanders agenda? Should we have found ways to appeal to people that left us for Trump? Where do you think they go from here?
This is, and again, this is not scientific. This is what I think. We've seen the back door of Clintonism. It is totally gone. It is not going to be resurrected in any way, shape, or form. As Bernie said, I was not a leader or a potential leader of the Democratic Party. I was the head of a movement. And we saw a lot of young, energized millennials out there. And I think those people in all 50 states are going to be the future of the Democratic Party. It's going to take time for them to grow and mature. But I think that's where the Democratic Party will be coming from. In essence, almost a throwback to its roots. Not its machine, not its pay-for-play, not its million-dollar benefits, charity, et cetera, et cetera. It is going to be back to the working man and woman out there, and it's up to the young people of America in that party to try to develop that model and try to bring it into the 21st century.
Okay. I think what we're observing here, I do take on board that stealing the election or the nomination is a very strong term to use. But my sense is that there is such revulsion against the machine, the political machine, the professionals in Washington, be they of the left or the right, mm-hmm. or the traditional left and right, Democrats and Republicans. There is such revulsion against that, that the desire to smash the system, and Bernie Sanders did represent smashing the system. Hillary Clinton represented a perpetuation of the same system with which everybody is fed up. And as far as a majority in the country are concerned, those systems are no longer delivering and they want change.
Okay, we'll pause for just a moment. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, a program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in studio, Tom Rivers and Rosemary Hollis. To Turkey now, a country which has today experienced yet another terrorist attack, this time in the city of Izmir. Turkey has experienced a string of attacks in recent months, from the assassination of Russia's ambassador to the massacre in an Istanbul nightclub on New Year's Eve. And yet, as a New York Times piece points out today, for many people in Turkey, including the media and even lawmakers, America is often blamed as the shadowy culprit behind the scenes. Rosemary Hollis, it seems a little strange from this distance to see how America can be blamed for an attack that is where responsibility has been claimed by ISIS. And yet you read some of the pro-government newspapers in Turkey and they are adamant that America is behind a lot of these attacks. Where does that come from?
Well, it's not uncommon in a time of crisis for the popular view to be that this must be blamed on some big power outside the country. And America is often a culprit, or often the preferred choice of culprit, across the Middle East. It's sort of sad to see it happening in Turkey, but I think it's partly because I would say, because they used to have a relatively free press. They used to have a very open debate in Turkey, and it would be impossible for that kind of conspiracy theory to sit up there unchallenged to the extent that it is today. But Turkey is deeply divided, almost down the middle, between supporters and opponents of Erdogan, who the president who seems set upon cementing his own power to the exclusion of rivals and reorganizing the system accordingly. And in a country divided, he is also choosing the Americans in part for practical reasons, because they did indeed help the Kurdish elements in Syria and Iraq to take on ISIS. And anything that increases the power of the Kurds on the Syrian or Iraqi side of the Turkish border is likely and substantially fuels separatism, anti-government nationalism amongst Kurds inside Turkey, which is an existential threat as far as Erdogan is concerned. And the Americans are much more sympathetic to Kurdish nationalism, at least just across the border, than ever a Turkish government could tolerate.
And Tom Rivers, there's also the issue here which confuses matters, which is that, you know, Turkey is a member of NATO and has been since the 50s. It has the second largest army, military, in NATO. And yet, when a terrorist attack or a series of terrorist attacks takes place in another NATO country, you see that alliance seem to come together and work together more closely. And America, as the biggest, most influential member, often comes in to help. Here we're seeing Turkey more interested, it seems, in turning to Russia.
Yeah, certainly the case. And look at the current talks with the rebels, or potentially the rebels, and representatives from Damascus. You're absolutely right. It is a strange cousin in the family of NATO, and it is treated like no other, if you will, country in NATO. So it is. It's got a, as Rosemary said, it's got a foot in both camps, in the east and the west, and you embrace it, but at arm's length. It is a strange situation. Always has been.
Well, also, it is relatively new that the Turks would become that close to Russia. They were in the forefront of NATO's defense against the Soviet Union, and that made them feel much more cozy with the rest of NATO until the end of the Cold War. And then for the duration of the 1990s and well into this century, Turkey was literally casting about for its new role in the post-Cold War era, and was, for a brief period under Erdogan, was talking about being friends with absolutely all their neighbours.
Zero problems in the neighbourhood was the policy.
And they then turned very anti-Russian because of Russian support for the Assad regime in Syria. What's most astonishing to me is the speed and extent of the latest twist in the story of who they're friends with, in that they've got back in with Russia and have become more anti-American, all in the Syria context.
And Tom, the speed and the twist there that Rosemary talks about, that's only possible if you're in an autocratic state where you have crushed freedom of speech to such an extent where actually most of the newspapers are echo chambers of what you put out, where there are very few people that want to put their head above the parapet and say something different from the government.
America might be about to make such a swift change.
But in the American sense, there's been an election, there'll be a governmental change of view, but that won't necessarily permeate down to, as we're seeing in Turkey, almost every newspaper, almost every view. Yep. Being like this.
No, you're absolutely right. And how long does this process last for, though? That's how long can you keep the lid on? And I don't know the answer to that, but you're absolutely right. You look at the people that have been detained since July, and the numbers continue to grow.
Okay, I want to move on to Brexit. I mean, I don't want to move on to Brexit, but we have to move on to Brexit. Britain's ambassador to the European Union quit earlier this week, warning his colleagues about the perils of muddled thinking. We're not quite sure whether he was talking about the Prime Minister or the Foreign Secretary or any of the other Brexiteers in government. But Sir Ivan Rogers has been quickly replaced by Sir Tim Barrow, a man who, of course, everyone will be familiar with. But he's been called a seasoned and tough negotiator by Downing Street, who will bring energy to the talks. We'll see. Rosemary Hollis, there's been an issue here in this country over the last couple of days about diplomatic independence, about the independence of the civil service, you know, hardline Brexiteers saying we must have someone who is as, you know, pro-Brexit as we are, which seems to sort of slightly ignore the civil service guidelines on civil servants being people who just implement the policy of the government, whether they agree with it or not. Is there an issue, though, here over diplomatic skills and negotiating skills, and a problem that perhaps Britain is lacking in these?
I think there's two or three issues all muddled in together. There's the British tradition that the civil service is non-partisan, and whenever there's a change of government or a significant change of policy chosen by the politicians, endorsed by the cabinet, then it's their job to offer the politicians two or three options of how to implement their choice of policy. And therefore, there's an issue of whether the critics of civil servants who point out the difficulties, such as Liam Fox, we're led to understand, and other pro-Brexiteers, that they shouldn't even be told that by a civil servant. They should just put up and shut up. Mm. But the other issue is, if there is disunity in the cabinet, if they really haven't got a policy yet, then the civil servants are stuck to work out the implications of following that policy and two or three ways in which it could be done. So there's a problem. The Sir Roger issue highlighted the problem. And I think the government has displayed pretty impressive spin in the last 24 hours to try and shut down that particular aspect of the problem.
Tom, there's a difference, isn't there, between having a negotiator who agrees with you,
right,
100%, and having a negotiator who has the skills to get you what you want, or as much of what you want. And it seems as if, you know, some people on the Brexit side would be far happier having someone who agreed with them completely rather than someone who had the skills to get them what they wanted.
Well, you want both. You want the skills and you want someone singing from the same sheet. And if there's a saving grace in this, we've got a few months till March, and that'll give Sir Tim Barrow time to try to get his feet under the desk and try to get rolling. If he is, in fact, of the same mindset, so to speak, with trying to get the job done, that will be a positive thing for the British government. But at this stage,
if they know what to instruct him.
Well, exactly.
Well, that was actually the most interesting thing about his resignation email, all 1,400 words of it.
So, Rogers.
Rosemary, yes. So Ivan Rogers' resignation email was that he suggested that he didn't know what the British strategy was, that he hadn't been told what they were supposed to be doing.
Nor apparently has the Queen, of course.
Well, indeed, which is perhaps sort of, which is amusing, perhaps sort of less of a sort of proper diplomatic issue, since I'm sure she's not going to be doing any negotiating herself. But that suggestion, Rosemary, that even the man who's supposed to be negotiating doesn't know what his government wants,
yes,
is surely an issue.
I find equally fascinating, though, in all of this, is what the assumption is about what makes a good negotiator, and the emphasis on the word tough. Like, this is what you've got to be with the other 27 members, because otherwise they're going to be obstreperous, and that this will achieve what Britain wants. Well, as has been pointed out by some other diplomats, you never go into a negotiation wanting to get 100% to go your way. You have to give and take. And therefore, I would suggest that you want a seasoned diplomat, because he knows, or she if there were such, knows where the give and take can take place, what the other guys value most, and you less so, that you can do a trade. And the problem with a convert to Brexit, a sort of political appointee, would be that they would not have that knowledge.
Okay.
And we're hoping that Sir Tim does.
There we are. We'll leave it there, I'm afraid. We're going to talk about airports. We didn't have time. We'll maybe talk about it tomorrow. Tom Rivers and Rosemary Hollis, thank you both very much indeed. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The studio manager was Kira Matthew Banerjee. There's music next. Then it's The Urbanist at 1900. Do stay tuned for that. Andrew Tuck will be your host. The Monocle Daily is back at 2200. Midori House back same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. That's 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.